Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hello and welcome to Your Booked, the podcast for literary nosy parkers. I'm Daisy Buchanan, your host and the author of The Sisterhood, A Love Letter to the Women Who Shaped Me. It's a book about how we're defined by the women in our lives and how they make us laugh, cry and occasionally want to set fire to things. It's described as a Nancy Mitford novel meets Fleabag, but it's a memoir. If that appeals, I think you'll like it. The Sisterhood is available from bookshops nationwide, and if you'd like to support the podcast, buying the book is the best way for you to do that. And if you're on the Kent coast, come and buy it from the Margate Bookshop, my lovely local. Also, I've got some events coming up that I think, if you're curious about books and author chat and what people read, that you will enjoy. This Saturday, if you're listening when the episode goes out, on June the 29th, I'll be at the Felixstowe Book Festival in the Orwell Hotel with Beth O'Leary, author of The Flatshare, and Olivia Byrne, author of The List That Changed My Life. These women are fantastic writers, so I'm really, really excited to be doing an event with them, and you get a glass of fizz with your ticket. I will also be at Lucy Vine's Hot Mess Clubhouse for a funny author special with Rosie Walsh and YB alumni Aisha Malik. Lucy Vine is, of course, an old guest of ours. That's at Gower Street Waterstones on July the 11th. And on Friday the 26th of July, I'll be at Tottenham Court Road Waterstones interviewing Rachel Deloach-Williams about her upcoming book, My Friend Anna. This is Rachel's account of her friendship with the famous fake heiress who dominated our news feeds last summer, the one and only Anna Delvey. It looks like tickets are going quite fast for that one, so I would go for it if you haven't already. Anyway, this week, we are by the seaside in Brighton with the award-winning novelist Dorothy Coombson. Dorothy has been writing fiction since she was 13 years old, and her 15th novel, Tell Me Your Secret, is out this Thursday. She says, "I wanted to look at what it means to be a survivor and a victim in today's world, and explore how the tentacles of crime reach out and encompass everyone, including those who aren't, at first glance, directly affected by the crime." Dorothy has been described as the queen of the big reveal, and this book will make you gasp. But Dorothy's skill as a storyteller lies in her ability to look beyond facts and explore emotions and the way human nature is affected by tension and tragedy. We talked about science fiction, about Dorothy's journalism career, and giving readers value for money. So this is a reading room.
Yes, kind of, yes. And that sounds really indulgent, doesn't it?
No, it sounds great. I think that
it's like aspire to, yeah.
Every person listening, if they don't have a dedicated reading room, they would... Yeah. I know my friend Jo, who's a big reader and listener, she's got... I mean, hers is a little bit smaller, but it's she's got a special book room. So where do you read most days? Can you read when you're writing, or do you have to keep it separate?
I used to stop reading when I was writing, because you end up kind of absorbing the story you're reading, don't you, and kind of making it into your book.
Suddenly, the rhythm of it.
Yeah, and you sort of start. So I try to avoid reading as much as possible when I'm writing. But, you know, I have books around. I have by the bed, in the toilet.
We need to go and look at those.
You do not need to go and look at my toilet. I pick up a book. But then, I get sent so much, and there's so much out there that I want to buy and, you know, and want to read. So I kind of stopped the not reading completely when I'm writing thing.
So is it just a case of trying to find things that are so different from anything you'd write that you won't be thrown by it?
Yeah, and also just sort of trying to stay focused as well. Because I do very short, intense, you know, 3 months of actually just writing, and then everything else is research and all the stuff around it. So for 3 months, it isn't that hard to not read other things or things that are similar. Because those are the intense period of just writing all the time.
So how does that work in terms of kind of the research? Do ideas come out of the research, or do you have a framework for what you're going to do and then go and kind of follow it up?
I have an idea initially. I'll get ideas from all over the place, you know, reading. Some people I know get ideas from reading problem pages, don't they? But I will hear a conversation, eavesdrop. I say this and people get very scared.
I read an interview where you said that you thought mobile phones were such a good invention because
great.
You can eavesdrop on people all the time and hear the rhythms of people's speech.
Yeah, see how they speak and conversations and pauses in conversations and the things that... Because people just walk around with the phone talking about anything and everything. And it's great for me because I go, oh, that'd be a great idea for a story.
But they're disinhibited, aren't they? And they've got it in their ear.
It's like they're at home, you know, sat in a room alone at home. But people do it all the time. So it's great for me to hear that and to hear how people speak and how to talk about different subjects. So I have a spark of an idea and that sort of, it kind of grows from there. In my head, I go, what if this happened next? And what if this happened next? And then as I'm going through the what if process, I'll then start researching and the ideas, you know, with Tell Me Your Secret, the idea came from several things. One of them being the whole Me Too thing and how I think a lot of people didn't come forward when things happened to them because it was shameful, they felt ashamed of what happened to them, but also because they didn't think they'd be believed. And people, you know, it feels a lot of the time that you have to be perfect. You have to be the perfect person before anyone will believe that something bad has happened to you and feel empathy for you and willing to, you know, the police to take it forward or to investigate it properly. And I wanted to write a book about people who aren't perfect, women who aren't the perfect victim and who basically have done things like drinking and drugs or, you know, having sex or swearing or just being normal women.
Clutching pearls.
Exactly. People who do inspire pearl clutching, you know, they're victims. And so they deserve to be just as believed as somebody who's deemed perfect. And there is so much you have to do to be on that perfect list for them to be, and then, you know, then to be accepted. So I wanted to tell those people's stories, you know, the victim stories, the imperfect victim stories. And also, with my books, I call them emotional thrillers because I want to tell the story of the emotions of the people involved. It's not so much about the whodunit element, although it's there. Mm. It's about what happens to the people. You know, something awful happens to them, and I want to know how they deal with it and how they move on with it and what goes through their heads. And so I wanted to tell the story of the victims of, you know, crime books and stories. Find out what actually happened to them and what they're going through, if they've survived it, something awful. Do they move on? Do you just move on with their life? Because, you know, the story ends, whether it's real life or fiction, the story ends and you kind of go, so what happened to them next? You know, did they manage to move on? Did they go back, you know, regress? Or did they feel terrible for the rest of their lives? So that was all this. Those are all the things that came into Tell Me Your Secret. And as I came up with the idea for that, I need to sort of read other people's stories and then talk to people who've been in sort of not the similar situation to Peter in Tell Me Your Secret, but people who've been in traumatic situations and how they managed to move on with their lives afterwards.
So it's a really different reading experience, isn't it? Because I think with a lot of thrillers that for lots of people, the appeal must be that kind of, oh, well, you know, that would never happen to me. I'd never be in any situation so weird or so gruesome or so shocking. But it's the empathy where, and I think, you know, you have your characters doing that a lot. There's that the sense that everything pivots on a what if, and there's no reason why it couldn't be any of us, that it's a kind of radical empathy.
Well, when I read stuff, I do actually often put myself into that person's shoes. I mean, apart from sci-fi stuff, which I love.
Really? But what kind of sci-fi do you read?
I'm a big sci-fi fan. I used to work in a comic shop in central London.
Is it
Forbidden Planet? Forbidden Planet. I used to work there, yeah. I used to read lots of comics. I used to read all the 2000 ADs. Latterly, I've got very much into all the Marvel stuff and, you know, as you can imagine, Black Panther t-shirt. So I love all that, and I like Doctor Who and...
So did that start when you were younger? Were you like a young reader, a teen reading sci-fi?
Yeah, when I was very young, actually, I used to, I'm sure, quite a few people used to buy lots of comics. I used to buy all the Bunties and, you know, Jackie and True Love, what was it, and Blue Jeans, all those ones.
Because I was a little bit, the Bunty was still sort of going when I was young, and my dad used to read his sisters, so I grew up on, but also like old Bunties, so yes. He'd like have the really old annuals,
and the annuals.
Occasional things like My Guy, and My Guy was great for the photo stories.
The photo stories in My Guy and Blue Jeans were fantastic, weren't they? They were so terrible, but I loved them. I used to read all those, and I used to, on the Saturday, I used to go and buy 2000 AD. My friends and I used to have a pool, we used to pool our money together so we can afford it. And then we'd pass it around.
Oh, genius.
So the person, obviously, you want to read it first, but the person who read it last got to keep it. So I used to try it and, you know, restrain myself to have it last. So I started then with those things. And I used to love Doctor Who, not so much. We didn't get to watch Doctor Who as much, but as time progressed, I watched
Doctor Who's really, really changed, hasn't it? Because it's such a sophisticated thing now. And I'm sure there are Whovians listening who'd be horrified by this, but I feel like it wasn't always as sophisticated as it is now.
I think they've just got more money now to do more things. Yes, I wrote a short story.
We are looking at the fireplace. Right hand side. Here we go. Doctor Who, the day she saved the Doctor.
Yes, four of us wrote a story. This came out in International Women's Day 2018, where we each wrote a companion story, a story about the companions, the people who travelled with the Doctor. And I wrote one for Bill, the last Doctor's companion before Jodie took over. Yes, I also wrote a Doctor Who audio story, which is obviously another great moment in my life.
Fantastic. This is a really beautiful addition. This is you, Susan Kalman, Jenny Colgan and Jacqueline Rayner.
Yes.
So that is fabulous. Have you written any kind of sci-fi or fantasy?
Only stuff that no one else is ever going to see. I'd love to write proper sci-fi. And I have lots of ideas and I have noted them down. I did years and years ago. I did actually start a lot of sci-fi stories. I've got a lot of things I've started and short stories I've started. They're still there. You know, I might do something with them at one point. I don't know yet.
That's exciting. So what is it about that sort of genre and those universes that appeal to you? Is it that you can do anything?
Can do anything. I just love the fantasy element of it. There's sort of the anything could happen element of it. And everyone looked great. And everyone seemed to be, you know, looking back now, you kind of watch them and read stories now and you go, oh, actually, maybe it wasn't as all peace, love and hope as I thought it was. But at the time, I loved it. I mean, Judge Dredd, absolutely. If you look at it now, it's actually quite a scary character. But I loved the idea of this judge who was emotionless and who just implement the law no matter what, whoever it was, you know, for whatever reasons.
God, that's so interesting, isn't it? Because I think that now we're at a time when it is so hard to find anything hopeful in the future. It all just seems terrible. So perhaps that's, you know, sci-fi and fantasy is where you go to find that optimism.
Yes, I suppose at that time it was just like a complete escape. I mean, like I say, when I read nowadays, the books I read that are set now in our real life, they kind of, oh, that could happen to me. Mm. But sci-fi stuff, obviously, I'm not going to get bitten by a radioactive spider or...
we hope.
I hope not.
Are there any sci-fi franchises you'd really like to write for?
Oh, I don't know. Do you know, at one point I wanted to write Judge Dredd, but now I think, I mean, Judge Dredd changed. It does. It all changes. You know, this was 30 years ago that I was reading it. So it's kind of, it's a long time ago and everything moves on and changes and becomes something completely different. And I don't know, I quite like, it's almost handing over the reins of what I... sort of like consumed to somebody else when it comes to sci-fi, because it's so removed and I don't need to worry about the storytelling or, you know, the implausibility of it. So I know a lot of people watched Handmaid's Tale, and I've never watched it because, as I say to people all the time, it's far too close to reality for my liking. And this was a couple of years ago, I was saying this to people, and now everyone's going, my goodness, it really is becoming reality. And for me, I couldn't face it. So that sort of sci-fi, I don't want to. But as Margaret Atwood said at the time, you know, all the stuff she wrote about was happening elsewhere in the world. It's just that a lot of us didn't, well, a lot of people didn't have an awareness that it was happening to people all over.
You don't really think it could still be happening, and that's how they get you.
Yeah.
Did you read it?
I read it years and years and years ago, a really long time ago, and I don't remember. I remember being completely shocked by it, but I don't remember as many elements about it as I do about other books I've read for some reason.
I think it's funny, isn't it, with a book, how sometimes it's the feeling of reading it that you remember much more. Yeah. There are books I love or that I couldn't tell you what happened plot-wise. What's the last thing that you read that really took you by surprise, where you thought, I'm not sure if this is for me or if I like this, and then you really found yourself connecting with it?
Oh, that's a question. Oh, I read recently Araminta Hall's book, Our Kind of Cruelty. That was very good.
Oh, so what's this about?
It's about a couple, and they've been together not a very long time, but they have this game they play called The Crave, and they go to a club, and she is approached by a guy, and she kind of flirts with him a bit, and then when the guy tries to take it further, he swoops in and saves her, and they play this game, and then he's kind of starts getting a bit strange, and he goes off to America to earn some money. And why is America? She breaks up with him and she meets somebody else and is about to marry this guy. And he comes back from America thinking that it's still part of the game and that she wants him to rescue her, and then does something terrible. And so it becomes like about the court case, and you're not sure if it is part of the game. Mm. It's told from his point of view, and he's got a very strange way of seeing the world and things he does. And you sort of, like, all the way through, you're kind of wondering, is it her? Is it him? And then you get to the end, you're like, oh, it's a bit quite shocking, the end.
I feel quite tense already. Yes, that sounds great.
It is a good book. I read Becoming recently as well, Michelle Obama's book.
I've got that on audiobook, and I keep thinking to sit down and, oh, not sit down, or because that's the joy of audiobooks, isn't it? You don't have to be sat down.
Yeah, no, it was, that was actually quite surprising because, I mean, I really admire her, and reading her book, her life is amazing, and what she has had to put up with is amazing as well. And the fact that she still comes across as a good person, despite all the hassle she gets, I mean, harassment, basically, and the things they say about her. I mean, she's one of the most beautiful people on earth, and they are constantly calling her ugly. And it's an awful thing to think that, you know, she's up there and she's still getting treated so badly.
And she is I think, you know, her sort of her grace and her presence, she's almost got like a gravitational pull. You just cannot believe. I cannot imagine that you could say anything awful about Michelle Obama and she'd sort of entertain it for a second, because it's like, well, no, you know, you are Michelle Obama. You're the most amazing woman in the world. But
to know that still... And wonderful things for other people as well. And that's the other thing that comes across, you know, how much she loves her family, but also how invested she is in the world and the next generation, particularly in girls being educated and being self-sufficient. And it's really sad to see that that's not valued by certain people, you know.
Guess as well that, because it's like, oh my God, I would not like to be married to the president, even if I did get to be married to Obama. No offence, producer Taylor. I think it's not an easy life for anyone. And I guess it's that it's really inspiring that, I guess she made that kind of that sacrifice because she'd be in a position to do so much more for girls and women.
But also you get very, and this is what I mean about being her championing girls being self-sufficient, she was a very highly placed person before, you know, she's a lawyer and she had all this, she was very educated. So all the way through the book, you get to the impression that they are equals, and he sees her as an equal. He doesn't see her as his spouse, somebody who's there. She is somebody who's on equal standing to him. So that makes their relationship seem, I mean, it seems like a great relationship, something to aspire to. I know when I was writing The Friend is about a woman who moves to Brighton with her husband, gets a big promotion here, and she doesn't want to move here, but he, I say here, I mean to Brighton. But she kind of realises that her marriage is going to be over if she doesn't move with him. So she comes with him and doesn't have a job. And she's always worked and she's always been very self-sufficient. And when she comes here, she doesn't have a job and, you know, she has to mould her life around the children's school times and things. And slowly but surely her husband loses respect for her. And that's part of the crux of it. You know, she's trying to find a new life and she's trying to make friends here, and then obviously gets herself involved in the mystery of what happened to one of the women at the school. But one of the things I wanted to explore in that was the idea that, you know, that your husband has always loved you and cared about you, but then when the circumstances change and he is theoretically in a stronger position, how he sees you as somehow lesser than. And that's what, you know, with Michelle Obama, it never felt like, when you're reading it, it never feels like he ever saw her as lesser than because he wasn't a lawyer anymore.
Because I suppose in lots of relationships, there are going to be times when one partner is busier than the other, yeah, or work means that one, but that doesn't mean, I think it's probably much more about how much everybody is valued, because yes, no work is necessarily objectively more significant, yes, than other work, and it's how you sort of have that interplay, I suppose.
But absolutely,
and that's really what, fascinating.
Yeah, that's one of the lines in there. One of the women in there, she's talking to, who says about how her husband wanted her to wait around for him to define how her life was going, and how she'd ring her up, you know, and say, oh, "I'm off," and didn't sort of like think that she might have something to do. And so she sort of said she had three choices, you know, to leave him, smother him to death in his sleep, or to sort of put up with it. So she said, obviously, I put up with it. But yeah, that is the power balance does change. And that was one of the things I liked exploring in the Friend.
I'm going to do a clunky segue, although it's because very close to Michelle Obama. Women who are often powerful in an unambiguous way. I see you've got Thrilled by Jackie Collins.
Oh, absolutely. And I've also got The Power Trip by Jackie Collins as well. And this one is, I think this one's signed.
Oh, wow. That's a fabulous edition. You've got gold end papers.
I know, yes. So she signed it, obviously, before she died.
Oh, and 2012. She's got very neat writing.
She's fantastic. She was always one of my writing heroes, Michelle. Jackie Collins. I used to love... I read all her books when I shouldn't have. I was very young.
So
I was like,
this kind of preteen, under the covers.
And my friends and I, we used to get them out from the library, and we used to pass them around with each other and read them together. And, you know, she wrote about all these strong women, and she always had a very strong sense of what a woman was about. So, now I look back and I think, maybe not as what I think a woman is, but at the time it was great. So there was always these powerful women. They were always in control, and they took charge, and, you know, they were always very strong.
I've just been reading Vendetta, but I'm really sort of taken aback by how... So this, I think it must be about 20, 25 years old, but it's that so many of the things that come up are things that are being talked about all the time. Absolutely. Online now. And again, it's a little bit like A Handmaid's Tale, where I'm like, thought it would have changed, but it's got worse. But also, it's really, I don't think I necessarily appreciated how perceptive she was. And I think when I was a teenager, I was like, oh, she's all the feminism, I just want to get to the sex. And actually, it's like, no, this is great.
I know, yeah, absolutely. I know I recommended them to my mother-in-law a couple of years ago, and she was saying to me, that was just the best recommendation ever, because I couldn't believe that she hadn't ever read a Jackie Collins. And then I sort of said to her, oh, you need to read a couple. And she's got loads of them. She went back and bought loads of them because she thinks they're fantastic as well. I mean, they are fantastic. She had a way of creating these characters. People, I mean, I probably would never meet, but you really cared about them, and you actually thought you kind of knew them by the end of the book.
I think for me, it's a little bit like reading sci-fi, because it's this world where everybody lives in billion-dollar penthouses and the cars are 10 miles long.
And they have swimming pools, and they...
That level of kind of fantasy.
And they walk around in heels and stuff, yeah.
Oh, I see you've got a lot of cookery books, and I always want to talk about cookery books, and you don't see as many of them as you'd like. Do you like to cook?
I do like to cook. I kind of come and go to cooking. A lot of these books came back from Australia with me when I lived in Australia.
When did you live in Australia?
Back in 2005 to 2007. So, and I collected a lot of books. And
what were you writing out there?
I worked on Family Circle magazine.
Ah, cool.
So I worked on there, and then that folded, so I had to come back. And so I stayed there and finished off Marshmallows for Breakfast, which was what I was writing at the time, and then came home. So I got a lot of these cookbooks from there, like the Donna Hay one, which I don't think you can really get here anymore. At the time, you couldn't get here, Donna Hay and Bill Ticos.
Let's have a look at Donna Hay. That's all. Yeah. It's quite wedged in.
I know, yes, that my cookbooks are all wedged in.
Ah, and it says Family Circle.
Yes, so they had a book. They had a book sale just before, when they folded, they had a book sale, so I bought that. It was...
I've never seen this, but this just looks like, you know, I mean, this is me every night going, what am I going to have for tea?
You
just pick it, open it up at any stage. So that's really exciting. Did the job come up and you thought, well, why not? I'll go to Australia.
Well, I went to a wedding in Australia and I thought, oh, it's quite nice here. I think I'll move here because, you know, single, you can do what you like. And then I saw the job advertised. I thought I applied for it and I got it. So I moved.
So were you working in journalism before that?
Yes, I used to be a journalist. Well, I still am a journalist, really. Newspaper magazines and things, editing and sub-editing, which is quite a dying art, and writing. Not as much writing, but mainly editing and stuff, yeah. I've got that book signed as well, that cookbook, Lisa Faulkner.
I don't think I know Lisa Faulkner. Recipes from my mother for my daughter. Oh, yes. That is a lovely concept. Dorothy, I really hope you like it. I can't quite believe I'm actually reading my favourite author, my book.
I'm sending.
Sending. Oh, that's so lovely. It's a gorgeous picture of Lisa Faulkner in here.
Yes.
And here, you've got a scones and quick raspberry jam.
Yes, I think I did. I made that, actually, I think.
Are you a cook or a baker, more, would you say?
I do both. I'm my husband always laughs at me because I'm not very good at following a recipe, so I'm always going off plan, and then
means you're a cook rather than a baker.
Yeah, things don't turn out.
You can be quite creative with cooking, but yeah. I've learned the hard way that in baking there is no room for improv.
Yeah, lots of measurements are needed. Yes,
with editing and sub-editing, it must be just so great for writing novels because you know about kind of economy and rhythm and how to.
Yeah,
things work on a page.
I think it's, for me, that's one of the best things because I always overwrite. I write far too much and then I have to go back and cut it down. But it's great. I love that. I love that bit of it. The cutting things down and sort of taking out big chunks and making it all make sense.
I think I read an interview where you said, was it your first novel where you had to cut out 50,000 words?
No, that wasn't my first novel. That was many novels in. It was The Woman Who Loved Before. I cut out 50,000 words, yeah. Because I overwrote so much and then had to just sit down and be ruthless.
How long does that take? Because I imagine it's not a case of just like highlighting the last.
I know, it's just going back, reading through. Because I don't write in order. I'd have to put it all together like a jigsaw. And then I go through and then as I'm reading through, I'm going, yeah, that doesn't work. That doesn't work. That's too, doesn't move the story. I mean, some of the best stuff you think you've written, but you have to...
kill your darlings.
That's it. You have to get rid of it because it doesn't move the story onwards. So
I think for anyone who writes or who'd like to write, I think it's really, really comforting to hear that you do sometimes, you get lost in the maze. Yes. And that not everything, that no matter how good you are. And I suppose perhaps the better you get, the more you end up being ruthless about your...
Yeah, I like being able to stand back and look at things and go, right, okay, that's not going to work and that doesn't... I mean, I'd rather do it rather than other people do
it.
Yes. So it's better. I always feel better if I do it rather than someone else tell me that something has to go.
That makes a lot of sense.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices.
Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
We'll be back to you, Dorothy, soon, but now it's time for my Steal of the Week, a book so valuable that you'd take a day off work and travel all the way to a distant bus depot in order to claim it from lost property. This week, I've chosen Big Magic by Elizabeth Gilbert. Now, I've done a real 180 on this book. For years, I dismissed it as hippie nonsense without actually reading it, which we all know is the most dangerous thing you can do with any book. But after our guest, Angela Clark, talked about how much she loved it, I decided to give it a try, and it really did start a revolution in my brain. Gilbert writes beautifully and honestly, as we all know, but she really captures how terrifying it feels to want to create anything, and how we can confront the audacity of the act and revel in the terror. It doesn't matter what you dream about, I believe this book will inspire you to do it, and it will make sure that you enjoy doing it. Big Magic is published by Bloomsbury, and it's out now. Now back to you, Dorothy. Yeah. I've just spotted two former podcast guests who are hanging out together on a shelf. Also, one introduced me to the other. So you've got Angela Clark and Erin Kelly. Yes. Angela introduced me to Erin in Bookwise and Lifewise.
Yes. These ones, I brought back these, the Jodi Picos.
Ah.
That's why they've got a different cover to... These are Australian ones. These are Australian versions, yeah.
Gosh, her Australian covers are quite sort of austere, aren't they?
Yes,
I've got the whole set up to that point.
And then there's the British ones here. So it's very different.
That's much sort of softer, isn't it?
Yeah, but... those are the two. That's the pattern.
Of all your editions, what are your own favourite covers? And are there any covers where you think, have they read the book?
of my books?
Yeah.
Well, I'm very fortunate. Most of my covers I'm involved with, except the foreign ones, some of them are like, oh, okay. Some of them are very different to what I would do. I know there's this. I'm trying to see. This one is kind of quite faithful. That's That Girl from Nowhere, and there's a whole butterfly theme, and that's Icelandic edition.
Oh, cool. It's very pretty. And I like, because it's got the kind of Oda Neely sort of turquoisey colour and the pink. And it's like the Northern Lights.
Yes.
Are the Northern Lights in Iceland, or have I got my geography wrong?
I don't know. That one is I think that's the Russian version of Woman Love Before.
Can you tell me about Slap Lekker Leave Chat?
That one. That is... I think that's...
Beautiful, I think.
Yeah, I think that's Goodnight Beautiful. Yeah, Goodnight Beautiful, that is.
Oh, God, that's a really... To see the cover and the hand holding the tiny, tiny shoes.
Yes.
It's a illustrated Hemingway story. A bit mush. Do you do many events outside the UK?
I have been to Portugal a few times to do events there, because my books, they sell quite well in Portugal. And... I've been to Lithuania as well. They sell very well there as well.
So how does that work? Do you have someone kind of on stage with you translating you? Or
yes, they have earphone things. But the Portuguese, a lot of Portuguese people really can speak English quite well. And, you know, they make more of an effort than we do to learn other languages. I know when the first time I went over, lots of the people who came to see me and to get their books signed came with their partners, and a lot of them said, oh, he could speak English. So he would say, oh, she really loves your books.
Oh.
And then a couple of years later, when I went back, they came on their own because they'd learned to speak English, and they sort of like said, oh, do you remember when I met you a couple of years ago? It was really nice.
Can you remember when you were little, when you went, either what books you bought or what books you sort of longed for when you were looking at the shelves?
I actually used to spend a lot of time in the library. I used to spend a lot of time in the library. I used to go to the library every day after school and read all sorts of things. I used to read all sorts. There was so much. There were so many books there. I mean, that's one of the things I love about libraries. There was so much there, and you know, you can just go there and spend hours there and pick up all sorts of books. I used to pick up all the big fairy tales, you know, and they're huge books, and I used to read them, and oh god, I read so much. I remember I used to get books out all the time. You sit there, you know, lie there in a cup under the covers reading them with the light from the corridor. I remember I became obsessed with Judy Blume.
It's funny because Judy Blume comes up so much.
Yes, I know, it's funny, isn't it? How sort of kind of segued from Judy Blume to Jackie Collins not long after. So
the gateway drug.
Yes.
I do think there's something for a certain kind of young reader where, when you're a kid who feels a little bit at odds with the rest of the world, the library is the one place where you can sort of go and try being an adult.
Yes.
Nobody else will have you. Like, the adults won't have you, the other kids won't have you, but you can go to the library and that can be...
Yeah, and no one knows what you're reading, what you've picked up, and all the stuff you know. You learn about all these fantastic things and no one knows.
There's still, the thing I always think about of Judy Blume is in Are You There, God, It's Me, Margaret, and the belt for the sanitary pads.
Oh, yeah, the sanitary pads,
that had sort of been phased out by the time it was, and I was really, really disappointed.
Well, I was just absolutely fascinated about what they were and how it worked. And, yeah, I remember that. I remember the notes in the toilet as well. That was one of the things that I remember quite vividly from the Judy Blume books. I remember I mentioned Forever in The Ice Cream Girls, because obviously it's about a girl who gets a woman who, when she was a teenager, gets involved with an older man, and she finds her teen daughter's reading Forever, and so she starts freaking out because obviously she knew Judy Blume was a gateway drug to all sorts of things.
I think it's really lovely, though, when you can kind of reference your own reading history in your books and put these Easter eggs. And I suppose that's quite a... that happens a lot in the kind of the comic book universe, doesn't it? Everything is sort of a little note from before. Yeah. I know we've talked a bit about really, you know, awful, heartbreaking, toxic relationships, but do you have any favourite love stories or favourite couples in books?
Oh, I remember... I don't know.
Oh, well, there's a beautiful book here of love poems. Penguin's Poems for Love.
They're great, actually. They're nice to just to pick up.
That's a really nice addition. It's a loose bound. These anthologies are lovely because with poetry, it's nice to kind of... I don't know, you want to read lots of things, but lots of different voices.
Yes.
Sometimes, I think.
Yeah, just dipping in and out. It's not... you're not sort of committed to the whole thing. I don't seem to have that many... love stories.
Happy endings.
Down here, yeah. One that I really enjoyed years and years and years ago was a Sophie Kinsella book, which was...
Oh, weirdly, I was just looking at the Shop of the Stars down there, so I was just thinking about Sophie Kinsella.
It was the one... Would I Lie to You or something like that? It was one about... She meets a guy on the plane. She sits next to this guy and she thinks they're going to crash, and so she ends up... telling him all her secrets, all the things she's done terribly wrong. And then a couple of days later, discovers that he's her new boss. And so she's told him all these things. I thought, that's quite a nice story. I like that one.
I think she's so good at plot and so good at premises. And I think it works because, as well as the kind of the rooting for... the romance. I think that the women she writes are so lovable themselves.
Yes,
there's kind of the extra. Love story with them as a reader.
Yeah, I know Gavanna Fletcher books. They're nice, heartwarming books.
You're rooting for everyone, and you know that you're going to.
Yes, there's her one there. Dream, a little dream. Here it is. You're the one that I want.
And there's Julie Cohen, another friend of the podcast.
Yes,
it's really lovely. Like, actually, the more we do, the more. The more pals we spot on bookshelves. Oh, there's another one as well. It's Shopaholic and Baby.
Yes, and there's Julie's Dear Thing as well.
And there's Gone Girl, not a heartwarming romance.
No, not at all.
Are there any kind of characters you've read where you thought you'd be really fun to hang out with in real life if you could go to lunch with anyone?
I quite like the characters from one of Linda Green's books. The one where the mums set up a political party.
I really like that cover.
Yes, it's a great cover.
Got a lovely kind of... Got a, describe it. Yes. It's sort of a kind of a grey lilac. It's called And Then It Happened, and it's a sort of silhouetted couple with a red umbrella. Mel Taylor was 13 years old when she found her Mr. Right. 20 years on, they remain blissfully in love. Seemingly perfect life is spoiled by a dark secret and a niggling fear that her good fortune can't last forever.
And then it happened.
And then it happens.
Yes.
So I'm going to read this. It looks fab.
Yes. She is great, actually. She writes more psychological thriller books at the moment. She was one of the Richard and Judy, recent Richard and Judy things. But her book, where there's four mothers who end up setting up a political party because they're so fed up of all the things that are happening around them, they decide to do something about it, and it's great because I like their characters.
That sounds like another book that's just become even more sort of prescient and relevant.
Was that? Oh, yes, absolutely. This was a great one.
Oh, The Nearness of You by Sarita Domingo.
Yeah, it's kind of, it's really nice sort of love story type thing. I'm not going to give too much away, but it's kind of, it's about a woman who meets a guy in a cinema and then meets him again. But unfortunately, he's with somebody else when she meets him again. But there's obviously a connection between them. Some of these books up here are my husband's books.
Do you share books much? Do you read things that you recommend to each other? Or do you have quite different tastes?
I think we have quite different tastes. Sometimes I'll read a book and I'll know that he'll really enjoy it. For example, after I read a couple of pages of the Araminta's book, I said to him, oh, you'll like this. So I gave it to him and he really enjoyed that. He also really enjoyed Apple Tree Yard. I knew he'd really like that as well, so I gave him... So I will start reading something, I think, oh, he'll enjoy this. So I give it to him, and he reads a lot faster than I do, so he will... he liked Girl on the Train as well.
Does he read your books?
Yes, he does, actually.
Does he read them kind of when they come out as books, or does he read kind of early drafts and things?
Oh, no, he doesn't read early drafts. No one reads early drafts. I finish a book, and then I send it off to my editor, and he reads it as books, so... He's currently reading Tell Me Your Secret, because he's away, so when he goes away, he reads them.
Is that so you can't like, look over his shoulder and be like, well, what do you think?
No, mainly because most of the time he gets to read when he travels quite a bit for work, so he gets to read then. I don't mind if he sits there taking forever to finish a book at all and to tell me what he thinks. I don't mind at all.
I do think it's so weird and interesting, isn't it? Because obviously... millions and millions of people read your books. Strangers read your books, and that's your job, that's your livelihood. But it's that very odd intimacy of someone you know very, very well reading something you've completely imagined and dreamed up.
Yeah, and him wondering if I've where I've come up with the ideas from, and if I'm going to smother him in sleep to death in his sleep. I wouldn't ever do that, obviously.
Three options. It's fine. I'm not gonna leave you. But I thought, you know, even with nonfiction, sometimes with good friends and with my family, they're like, well, we never ever would have sat down and had a conversation where I told you all of the stuff about myself, because it would just be extremely boring for you. It's just all this information.
It's this there, and you have to sort of take it in as well. And you have no sort of comeback until you've finished it, do you really?
How do you find the sort of, because I'm guessing you must get sent a lot of books for kind of reviews and quotes and things. Is that exciting, overwhelming, bit of both? Do you have storage issues?
Storage issues, yeah, especially because I, like I said to you before, I tend to buy the books that I've been sent, so that, you know, to support the writer.
Such a lovely, lovely thing to do.
And well, it's kind of respecting your industry, because, you know, that's what we do. We want people to buy our books, and so I should... buy people's books as well, whether I'm sent it or not. Yes, I do like getting them, but I so much time squeezed at the moment. It's just really hard trying to write and trying to research and then do everything else, you know, you have to do with the book, and then trying to read as well.
Are there any kind of either classics or things that came out, you know, 5 years ago or 10 or 20 years ago that you've always, always wanted to read, but you've just never had a minute to get around to? Your kind of eternal to-read list.
It's weird, because I hardly ever get to read... You know the books, the big hyped books? Because Girl with a Dragon Tattoo, my husband read them. I haven't read any of them. I read one Harry Potter. I haven't read any more. There's so many books that are like, you know, the biggest selling ones that I very rarely get a chance to read, because there is almost so much else to read, and then suddenly it's like, oh, it's passed me by.
And I think sometimes with those books, they're so out there, and you feel as though you can absorb so much of them without...
Yeah, you don't actually need to.
I feel a little bit like that with Game of Thrones. I've never watched a single episode of Game of Thrones.
That kind of passed me by.
What sort of books do you sort of share books with your parents, or... Are there things that they've sort of recommended that you've loved?
Not really, actually, no. It's completely different. My dad used to like political books and stuff. I don't know. My sister reads very different types of books to me, but she reads my books, but she reads a lot of literary books.
I think it's such a funny sort of classification that we have now, isn't it?
And
often think that all that really makes a book, you know... I'm doing air quotes here for everybody listening at home, doing air quotes, you know, literary or commercial. It's just kind of often the packaging.
Absolutely,
as much as
yes.
anything.
Yeah, and the subject matter, I suppose. Mm. I mean, I like reading all sorts of books. I do read some literary books, but I do tend to gravitate towards more commercial, as they say, books.
Did you read Wolf Hall? Will you be reading the new one?
No, I haven't actually read it. Is it there?
I've never read Wolf Hall. I can see Beyond Black.
Yeah, I don't think I have Wolf Hall. No, I haven't actually. I think my husband read it. I haven't read it.
It's definitely... That's on my eternal to read.
To read,
I
yeah.
will get there one day.
Yes.
Because there is quite a lot of non-fiction.
I use it for research and for subjects, central subject to a book. I will get a load of books in that subject and read them.
Are there any books you've read or writing advice that you've really found sort of useful or helpful?
Yeah, a lot of people, they find it, the Stephen King book on writing very helpful. I haven't read it myself. I have read his other books. I have read his fiction books.
Did you read those sort of as an adult or a teen or just throughout when they came out?
Throughout, actually. I remember, obviously I can't read it because that's just like my idea of hell.
Clowns.
Clowns. But I read a lot of like Green Mile, and the one that became Stand By Me, was that called The Body... The Body in the Woods or something.
And I still think a lot about Carrie, and I think that's amazing.
Yeah,
but in the way it's presented as journalism.
Yes, I know, and it's really quite... Because it's so... I mean, that's like the ultimate teen book, isn't it? But it's kind of awful.
There's a real kind of economy to it that I really, really like. And I think sometimes, God, I'm going to be thrown out of somewhere for saying this, but occasionally, I think because I'm not someone who loves... getting very, very scared. I do find bits of, you know, later books a little bit bloated, like obviously because he's such a megastar. Mm. You know, sometimes there are writers who don't have the good sense to say, I need to lose 50,000 words to have that courage.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of being scared. I get very, because I think about it. It's not so much watching it is one thing or reading it is one thing, but it's the afterwards and the sort of line they're going. Do you remember when that thing happened in that and that person, and then you hear, because you know you hear sounds, you're like, what was that? So I actually scare myself more than the actual thing I read or watched it. So
I think that's it. That I think you're either the sort of person who's like, ah ha ha, that will never happen to me.
Yeah,
like, that could definitely happen to me.
Yeah,
and
that's what you're waiting for. One of the best bits of writing advice I think is to read actually, because people don't read and. You can't write without reading. And people often have said, you know, oh, I don't read anything out there. It's all rubbish. And I was like, good luck, because read...
How do you know if you're not reading
Absolutely.
It?
And also, you just need to know what's been published and what stories are out there. And so, yeah, I think that's the best writing advice, apart from just write it.
When time allows, do you reread much? Or are there any books that you've read many
very
times?
Very rarely reread stuff. The only thing that I probably reread is... my own books, because I want to see how I did something and to see which bits of something I might change if I was writing them now. I wouldn't go back and change things, but if I was rewriting them in the present, the things that I would change.
So growth and development.
Well, yeah, absolutely.
Do you feel very, very connected with your books? Do you sort of start and go, oh yes, I know what this book is? Or do you ever read bits of your own books where you think, I have no memory of writing this?
Sometimes I don't remember. Sometimes I go, wow, that's really good actually. I wrote that. Wow. Yeah, but when I'm in writing the book, I feel like I'm that person and I'm all walking that journey with them. And then we get to the end and it's like, oh. You know, because I put my characters through a lot. So when I get to the end, I feel really bad for them.
It's something that you said that I know about how it's a great compliment if someone assumes if you've written a sort of central character and, you know, a lazy journalist reviewer is like, well, obviously this is who the writer is, because that just shows how connected that are to that person and how well you've drawn them.
For me, when I'm writing a book, it isn't, I never think, oh, I'll bash it out and I'll send it off. I can't do that. I have to feel like I've lived that journey with them and then get to the end, and when I rewrite it and then, you know, getting in the elements of who they are, when I hand it over to my editor, I don't ever feel like, oh yeah, can do what you like with it. I can't ever feel like that, because, you know, they are a part of me. And
it sounds like you're very close with the readers as well, in terms of what you want their experience to be.
Well, I want them to have a good time when they're reading it, not necessarily a happy time, but I want them to be, you know, to be connected to it. And also I want them to feel like I've, when they've spent their $8.99, their $12.99, I want them to know that every word I've thought about it, and I've done my best, you know, and I've done my best to make sure that they get their money's worth for that book, you know, and that I've never sort of like thought, okay, I've done it now, I'll just walk away from it. I always want people to, because, you know, it's earning your money is really hard, and I want people to, and, you know, I remember what it's like to have to make the choice between getting on the train to work or eating. So, and I know people who buy my books, a lot of them do have to make those choices. Yeah. They are financially strapped. So when they spend that money on a book, I want to make sure that they enjoy every second.
Doing it casually. Exactly. It's a real treat.
Yeah, absolutely. So I do want to feel connected to them as well, so that they know that I've created this character, I've created this world, and I want them to enjoy it. Like I say, not necessarily be happy, but enjoy the read experience or learn something from it. Yeah.
You might not want to answer this, so we'll see how it goes. The experience of being edited, do you feel like that is a sort of positive and constructive, or do you ever get editorial feedback where you're like, I don't think so, no?
Well, having been an editor or sub-editor who's cut things, you know, you have to cut things to fit onto the page. When I get the feedback, I always think, okay. And then I'll sit back and I'll go, actually, do you know what? They're probably right. They've got a point. And I will change something. Not necessarily how they wanted me to change it. I will change it to fit the character or the story or my personality. But yeah, it's not easy being edited, but it's not awful for me. But I do want to be involved. I am very involved in a lot of the stuff that I do. So, and in my book, you know, I can't, like I say to you, I can't just send it in and go, do what you like with it, and then sort of see it 6 months later on the shelves. I have to be involved at every stage. And if someone says to me, I don't think this is true, this wouldn't happen, I always think, well, I think it would, but I just need to either get back up so I can check with an expert to see that if that would happen like that. If not, I would rewrite it so it's true to the story and not just true to have a good twist, you know, because that's... The temptation is really there to sort of go, oh, I'll just do this to we've got a massive twist and no one will guess it. But then if you look at the character and you look at what their situation they're in, you're not being fair to yourself or to the reader, to the character. So
weirdly, my dad always says that about Agatha Christie, that he thinks that what he really, really likes about her is she's very sort of collaborative with her reader. It's shocking and it takes a lot of guessing, but he doesn't think there are any books where you're like, that came out of nowhere, that it's quite respectful.
Yes, you have. Yeah, that's it. That is it, being respectful. And you kind of put the clues in. You put the clues in there so that people can see that, look back and they go, oh, yes. Oh, yeah, that was there. That was there all along. It's just that you weren't seeing, which is why, you know, it drives my husband crazy. We were watching something and I'll go, well, that's that. And he'll go, can you just not? because I will, and that's why I read quite slowly. That's my other thing. My other problem with reading is I read very slowly because I read every word and I absorb all the little clues and stuff. So it's very rare I won't guess the twist because I have seen the clues and the way that someone's written that they've put a word in or they've put in a scene and you go, oh, I can actually... And then get to the end and go, yes, that was the point when you kind of guess.
I mean, do you think that's the journalist in you, always looking for the story in the story?
Yeah, maybe it's just annoying person in me.
I don't think that's true.
When I was very young, I used to read a lot of Sherlock Holmes stuff. I used to love that, the Sherlock Holmes world, you know. Again, some of the things I look back and I think, oh, it's quite problematic. But I liked the detective element and... the who he was and how he was a very flawed character, but also how he worked things out and logically worked things out. I really liked that.
I suppose there's a touch of the Judge Dredd to Sherlock Holmes,
yes,
isn't there?
Yes, that cold, it's a cold, emotionless
pure
man.
Pure logic.
Yes, absolutely. See, a lot of detective stories, a lot of them are too extreme for me. I like a lot of crime books, but I don't sort of fall in love with the character, with the detective, if you see what I mean. And I wish that there were more female detectives that I could relate to.
They're all like, he drinks whiskey and keeps himself to himself since the divorce.
Yes, exactly. And I like that. I do like reading that in a book, and I do think it adds to that story. But there aren't ones who are like me, as in detectives who are like myself.
Because I suppose that's it, isn't it? That you can't, because sometimes I read them and I just feel, well, I'll never solve this. Yeah. But if you can have that empathy and be like, well, you know, we can solve it together.
Yeah, and you can be a normal person. And that's one of the things with my books, I hope I get across. An ordinary person does end up solving. Very few of them are detectives. And Tell Me Your Secret is different because one of the characters is a detective. But she has her own motivations for... It's not just about solving the crime. That's not just her job. Whereas in The Friend or The Brian Mermaid or even a bit in The Ice Cream Girls or The Woman Loved Before, they're all ordinary people like me and you who end up solving the crime, you know, sometimes accidentally, but a lot of time through trying to work out what the mystery is.
It's quite empowering, I think, isn't it, to give that to...
Yeah,
to take it out.
To anyone, it could be anybody. It could be you. You could be that person standing there who ends up solving the crime of the century.
I finish on another raunchy fave. I see Jump by Jilly Cooper with the exclamation mark.
I can't remember why I got that.
So have you read any of the others?
I haven't actually read any Jilly Cooper. It was always I was always a Jackie Collins.
Madonna and Kylie. You're very much a more tamper than the other. Because I was definitely more Jilly than Jackie as a teenager. But I'm having a real Jackie. But then I do remember just... I remember reading The Stud when I was 13 or 14 and being obsessed with this idea that, is it Fontaine? And her whole house seems to be made out of like shag pile carpet. She's got furry walls and a furry lift. And...
Oh, yeah, no, I was, I remember, Sydney Sheldon, I used to like that as well.
I don't know Sydney Sheldon. Oh. Tell me.
Sydney Sheldon was like Jackie Collins, but male writing these. I can't imagine reading them now, but what they'd be like. But yeah, they used to have also a mini series as well. It was a bit Lace as well. Remember Lace?
Oh yes.
Which one of you is my mother? I love Lace as well. It's all the 80s and the big hair.
Nice.
There's one with
American.
He's American. Was it Something to Midnight? Something to Midnight. Where there's a woman who ends up getting stitched up and ends up in prison, and then she comes out of prison wanting revenge. It's fantastic. It is fantastic.
I'm going to be tracking this down because it sounds great.
Yes, absolutely.
Huge thanks to Dorothy. She's at Dorothy Coombson on Twitter. And follow her and tell her how much you love Tell Me Your Secret. It is great. I think that you'll really, really love it. I'm Daisy Buchanan, and I've been your book inspector. Thank you so much for joining me, fellow shelf obsessives. You can find me on Twitter at NotRollerGirl and on Instagram at TheDaisyBee. Say hello, suggest some guests, and watch out for shelfies. Visit our show page, acast.com/booked, for more information about our guests and a list of the books they've talked about. If you've got any other queries about the podcast, email us at whybooked@gmail.com. Your Booked is produced by Dale Shaw for New Alaska and hosted by Acast. Please do subscribe, rate us, and leave a review. It's great to hear what you think, and it helps other people find the podcast. For now, I leave you with some words from Stephen Wright. A lot of people ask me, if I was shipwrecked and could only have one book, what would it be? I always say, How to Build a Boat.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus,
Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.